Colonel Burke, Reel 6.
You also suggested when we spoke last that another of the things which characterised the pre-war army for you was that the senior officers were much more autocratic figures. I wonder if you could explain that and give me a few examples.
Well, yes. For instance, if you did anything like I did one day, I passed the colonel's wife without seeing her. Because I don't know why. Anyhow, next morning I was out with my platoon working, and I suddenly, an orderly came along, said I was wanted in the orderly room. So you go to the orderly room and you see the adjutant, and he said, the colonel wants to see you. So he said, I'll see if he's waiting. Well, sometimes you had to wait. And then you went in front of him. He'd be reading or writing. He wouldn't hurry to look up, go on reading. He'd stand there, and then he'd say, you know I brought you here? No, sir, I'm the fence setter. I can't think I've done anything wrong. Well, you refused to salute my wife this morning. I said, I didn't see it. You refused to salute my wife. They wouldn't take any reason that you... I was possibly looking at a book of a thing I was going to explain to my platoon in probably 5 minutes' time. Made no difference. He said, I don't want that to happen again. No, sir, I'm very sorry. Well, then, the end of the morning came, and I happened to be the first back in the mess, in the anteroom, and suddenly the colonel walked in. Well, of course, I prayed I could have fallen through the floor, instead of which, to my absolute astounding, he said, would you like a drink, but gave me a drink. You see, your discipline was strict. Sometimes it seemed absolutely unfair.
In what ways?
Well, they gave you no answer. They never told you why you'd done anything wrong. And so it seemed unfair to me. But they never bore malice.
Attitudes to marriage, you mentioned.
Oh, yes. If you suddenly thought you'd like to get married and you were warned, don't you? Will do that without saying, I said, I'm not going to see the car. Why the hell should I see the car? You can't get married without. And you see, he might, if you did, you might not get your marriage allowance. They could stop it, and if they didn't, it wasn't so much if they didn't like, you see, there were no quarters in those days. You hadn't a lot of money. And above all, they thought that marriage would ruin your career inasmuch as you wouldn't take so much trouble with your men. You wouldn't take so much trouble learning about the offensive and tactics and that sort of thing. That's what they were afraid of.
Mm.
Not so much that you might be marrying what they thought was beneath you.
Mm. When you got into civilian clothes and went off into town or something, I think you told me you'd be inspected as well then.
Oh, yes, very often for a long time. When you joined, the adjutant would have to see that you were going out properly dressed. I mean, it was the thing to carry a stick and gloves. You didn't go out with no hat or anything like we do today. I mean, when you went to the War Office, you had to wear a bowler hat, kid gloves and a walking stick, if you went in monthly.
Would it be unusual for the adjutant to find fault with your civilian dress?
Yes, he didn't like it. Unless you were going off to a sports meeting or to watch football, they didn't like you going with grey trousers and a different coat. They wanted a suit.
So they'd send you back to quarters to change, would they?
Well, they suggested you should go in.
Mm-hmm.
But the suggestion was practically an order.
Yes. This extreme formality is extremely interesting. Did it present many practical problems for you? I mean, was dressing for dinner a sort of major operation for you?
Oh, yes, because we had to get into a little Eton red jacket with our colours on the lapels and cuffs, and there was a white waistcoat with the gold regimental buttons. But it was the overalls, as they were known as, to get in. They were practically skin tight. So your batman, he put the Wellingtons, which were long boots, like a present-day Wellington. I think the present-day Wellington got their name from them. And there were your dress Wellingtons or your marching Wellingtons. The dress Wellingtons were like patent leather. But they had to be put inside the boot, inside the trouser, and come down, and the trouser each side had a strap with a buckle and strapped underneath. And then you simply pull these things on and got up. And it wasn't impossible to kneel, but if your stuff was worn a bit, you would stretch it, and of course anything might happen. But you got into this thing. That was the most difficult thing. Well, now on a Sunday morning for the church parade, you practically got your servant to help you into your tunic, which was sort of padded in places if you were different. And you had a huge cummerbund here, you see. You took your sword out of the leather scabbard and went into a sort of silver one, which you had a thing coming down to take it, two buckles. And you had this huge helmet with a spike on the top of it. And this terrible collar, which you couldn't move your neck. Well, on a Sunday morning when we went to, we used to dress and then put on what they're known as the monkey jacket, which was the blues they wear today. Put on that and go home after breakfast back to your room, and your servant would be ready to pull you into this thing, you see. Ease the sleeves up and then down. And see, your belt was absolutely true round your waist, you see, and your sword hanging as it should be. And then off you went for parade. It was an ordeal, parades in those days.
Mm. One of the other features of life you mentioned to me before was tea dances. What were they?
Oh, yes. Well, in the afternoon, you see, if you went off into the town, you would go to a tea house or any place where they were having tea. And there might be a what is known as a thé dansant, which was their tables were all round the floor, and you paid sixpence extra, I think, to go in, or a shilling extra, something very cheap anyhow. And you would know very well that there would be lots of the officers' daughters there, or some of the friends you'd met in civil life of the town, you'd met in the town, and you would dance with them. Not necessarily sit with them. You might be sitting at your table, and then you go over and dance, and then carry them back to their, or take them back to their table, thank them for the dance, and return to your own. And that sort of thing. The same with, we had to do, when we went to a town first, everybody called on you. Now, the main calls, like returning the call to the Admiral of the Port, and the mayor, was done by the senior officers. But a lot of these other ones they didn't want to go to, so the adjutant used to dish out so much, so many, you'll have to do these, now you'll do some this afternoon. And you go and call on these people. Well, if they weren't in, you left two cards, you see, to show you'd call one from the regiment, one from yourself, to show who you were. If they were in, you still left those cards. Because in those days there was always a salver on the hall stand, and you left them as you left, not when you went in. But if they weren't in, you gave them to the housemaid, and she put them there. And that had to be done whether you wanted it or not. Well, that was terrible boring, you know, trying to balance a cup of tea in one hand and be the perfect gentleman trying to pass things to other people, and you didn't know where to put it down. And I was always clumsy, breaking things, and you felt a fool. And
Fine. Now, we're getting quite near the end now. One thing, probably the most important part of our discussion, I think, and one which interests me greatly, is the training of a regular soldier during this time, because this, as a young officer, was, after all, your responsibility.
I joined at the depot. And at the depot, it was known as the 3rd Battalion, And at the depot, there was the commanding officer, the adjutant, two captains and two subalterns. And they trained all the recruits that came in. Now, in those days, the only thing to train us with was the bayonet and the rifle. But they used to say it took 2 years to train a soldier. And 18 months of that was spent at the depot, and the last 6 months was spent with the home battalion. Now, I say the home battalion because each regiment had two battalions.
You said that it took 2 years to learn to use a rifle and bayonet. There must have been some kind of order of things in the training procedures.
Well, when I said rifle and bayonet, I meant to train the man solidly. He first of all came with us, and for weeks he was on the square, learning to stand to attention, stand at ease, form fours, you see, turn to your left, turn to your right, about turn. Well, it seems easy, but to do it properly and gracefully, it took months and months and months of training. Then you learnt the same thing with arms, but you first had to learn the arms drill. It was slope arms, order arms, present arms, change arms, trail arms, and all those had to be learnt. And then they had to be learnt together. So it's synchronized. If you had 120 men, it sounded like one man when you ordered arms from the slope and they lowered their rifles, not banged them, lowered their rifles onto the ground. Okay? And all those sort of things. Well, then apart from that, they had physical training.
Before we finish with the rifle and bayonet, we've stopped at the sort of ceremonial side and haven't moved on to the actual business end of the operation. For example, what about musketry courses? How were the men instructed here?
Yes, you see, you'd have to learn all about your arm before you learned how to fire it. Well, then we would have musketry lessons in which they were taught how to aim and how to recognise targets. Now, there were three large poles about 6 foot long, and they had a big ring over them, and the ring was attached by a piece of cord about 18 inches long to one of the poles. Well, you put these poles, when they were fixed, in a pyramid position so that they rested on the ground, and where they passed one another halfway up, you put a sandbag. Now, on that sandbag, you rested the man's rifle. And then you taught him to aim. You showed him what an aim was, and you asked him to look. And then you moved the rifle and asked him to do the same thing. Well, when he got better, you had targets which you had a hole in. And you'd get him to aim, and you were the other side looking through, and you could tell whether he was aiming properly, and you could tell him that his foresight was too low or too high, and that sort of thing. And then he learnt to recognise targets, and you had long 6 foot by about 3 foot sort of area of landscape. And on that there were certain things where there might be a haystack, you see. Well, you'd say to him, haystack on the left, remember that. In the middle there was a tower on the right. On the right there was a bushy top or a fir tree. There were only two kinds of trees for recognition of targets, bushy top or fir trees. You see? Well, right, you had him there. So then you wanted to get him to identify a certain patch of ground. So it was on the left of the target, on the right of the target, we'll say. So you said bushy top tree, so he'd look to the right. And then you taught him 600 yards. And you'd say 600 yards. And you taught him, too, at the bushy top tree, an imaginary clock around it. You see? And so you'd want him to find this target. You'd say, 600 yards, bushy top tree, right. 7 o'clock. So there's the tree. He'd look on a line, 7 o'clock. You see? And then down that line, you'd say, in the field, a gravel patch. and you get him then, say, five rounds rapid fire. Right, well, when you got to the gravel patch, you'd stop and go and look to see if he'd got it.
I see, yes.
That was the way you taught in those days recognition of targets.
Yes.